Harih Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Sahabiryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavadhitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai Om Shanti 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 Om Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shiva Sadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Okay, so Robert Nelson is speaking. Afterward, I went up to him. He had a big smile, and he said that he likes young people to take to Krishna consciousness. He was very serious about it. He wanted all the young people. So I thought that was very nice. It made sense. So I wanted to help. We stood there talking for about an hour. Mr. had a library in the back, and we looked at certain books, Arjuna, Krishna, chariots, and things. And then we walked around. We looked at some of the pictures of Swamis on the wall. By that time, it was getting very late, and Prabhupada had come back the next day at 10 to his office downstairs. The next day, when Robert Nelson went to room 307, Prabhupada invited him in. The room was clearly not intended to serve as a living quarters. There was no toilet, shower, chair, bed, or telephone. The walls were painted a dark, dismal color. Prabhupada showed Robert the three-volume set of Srimad Bhagavatam, which Robert purchased for $16.50. Then Prabhupada handed him a small piece of paper with a Hare Krishna mantra printed on it. Robert: while Swamiji was handing it to me, he had this big smile on his face, like he was handing me the world. We spent the whole day together. At one point he said, "We are going to take a sleep." So he lay down there by his little desk. And so I said, "I am tired too." So I lay down at the other end of the room, and we rested. I just lay on the floor. It was the only place to do it. But he didn't rest that long, an hour and a half, I think. And we spent the rest of the day together. He was talking about Lord Chaitanya and the Lord's pastime, and he showed me a small picture of Lord Chaitanya, Nityananda and Advaita. He had a picture of the five of them and a picture of his spiritual master. He said some things in Sanskrit, and then he translated. It wasn't much of a room, though. You'd really be disappointed if you saw it. Robert Nelson couldn't give Prabhupada the kind of assistance he needed. Lord Chaitanya states that a person has at his command four assets: his life, money, intelligence, and words. At least one of which he should give to the service of God. Robert Nelson did not seem to be able to give his whole life to Krishna consciousness, and as for money, he had very little. His intelligence was also limited, and he spoke unimpressively. Nor did he have a wide range of friends or contacts among whom to speak. But he was affectionate towards the Swami. And out of 8 million people in the city, he was practically the only one who showed personal interest in him and offered to help. From his experience in the record business, Mr. Robert, as Swamiji called him, developed a scheme to produce a record of Swamiji's singing. People were always putting out albums with almost anything on them, he explained, and they would always make money, or at least break even. So it'd be almost impossible to lose money. It was a way, he thought, he could help make the Swami known. He tried to convince Prabhupada of the idea. And Prabhupada didn't discourage Mr. Robert, who seemed eager to render this service. Robert, me and the Swami went around to this record company on 46th Street. We went there and I started talking. And the man was all business. He was all business and mean. They go together. So he went in there with the tape, and we tried talking to the man. Swami was talking, but the man said he couldn't put the tape out. I think he listened to the tape, but he wouldn't put it out. So he felt discouraged, but he didn't say much about it. Prabhupada had been in business in India, and he wasn't about to think that he could suddenly take up business in a foreign country on the advice of a young boy in New York City. Besides, he had come not to do business, but to preach. Robert, however, was enthusiastically offering service. Perhaps he wouldn't become a regular brahmachari student, but he had a desire to serve Krishna. For Prabhupada to refuse him would be, perhaps, to turn away an interested Western young person. Prabhupada had come to speak about Krishna, to present the chanting. And if Mr. Robert wanted to help by arranging for an American record album, then that was welcome. Mr. Robert and the Swami made an odd combination. Prabhupada was elderly and dignified, a deep scholar of the Bhagavatam and the Sanskrit language, whereas Robert Nelson was artless, even in Western culture, and inept in worldly ways. What's an inept? Inept is like not really very good at anything. You can't really do anything. You can't do it properly. If you're inept at it, it means you can't. You have no skills, right? Does that make sense? Right? Inept in riding a bicycle or something means you don't do a very good job. You fall off or bump into things, or it's like not impressive. Robert Nelson was artless even in Western culture and inept in worldly ways. Together they would walk, the Swami wearing his winter coat with its imitation fur collar, his Indian dhoti and white pointed shoes, Mr. Robert wearing old khaki pants and an old coat. Prabhupada walked with rapid, determined strides, outpacing the lumbering, rambling, heavy-set boy who had befriended him. Mr. Robert was supposed to help Prabhupada in making presentations to businessmen and real estate men, yet he himself was hardly a slick fellow. He was innocent, Robert. Once we went over to this big office building on 42nd Street, and we went in there. The rent was thousands of dollars for a whole floor. So I was standing there talking to the man, but I didn't understand how all this money would come. The Swami wanted a big place, and I didn't know what to tell the man. Prabhupada wanted a big place, and a big place meant a big price. He had no money, and Robert Nelson had only his unemployment checks. Still, Prabhupada was interested. If he were to find a building, that would be a great step in his mission. And this was also another way of engaging Mr. Robert. Besides, Krishna might do anything, give anything, or work in any way, ordinary or miraculous. So Prabhupada had his reasoning, and Mr. Robert had his. Robert. The building was between 6th and Broadway on 42nd Street, some place to open Krishna's temple. We went in and up to the second floor and saw the renting agent. And then we left. I think it was $5,000 a month or $10,000 a month. We got to a certain point and the money was too much. And then we left. When he brought up the prices, I figured we had better not. We had to stop. On another occasion, Robert Nelson took Prabhupada by bus to the Hotel Columbia at 70 West 46th Street. The hotel had a suite that Prabhupada looked at for possible use as a temple. But again, it was very expensive, and there was no money. Sometimes Robert would make purchases for Prabhupada with the money from his unemployment checks. Once he bought orange-colored t-shirts. Once he went to Woolworths and bought kitchen pots and pans and some picture frames for Prabhupada's pictures of Lord Chaitanya and his spiritual master. Robert, one time I wanted to know how to make chapati cakes. So Swami said, $100, please, for the recipe. $100, please. So I went and got some money, but I couldn't get $100. But he showed me anyway. He taught me to cook and would always repeat, wash hands, and you should only eat with your right hand. And whoever met the Swami was almost always impressed. They would start smiling back to him, and sometimes they would say funny things to each other that were very nice. The Swami's English was very technical always. I mean, he had a big vocabulary, but sometimes people had a little trouble understanding him, and you had to help sometimes. Yeah, you'll see all throughout, whatever it is, whenever Prabhupada meets people or interacts, that everybody's always impressed. They're always finding to be very cultured and gentle, and that, you know, never rough or unsophisticated or anything. The Paradox at 64 East 7th Street on the Lower East Side was a restaurant dedicated to the philosophy of George Oshawa and the microbiotic diet. It was a storefront below street level with small dining tables placed around the candlelit room. The food was inexpensive and well-reputed. Tea was served free, as much as you liked. More than just a restaurant, the Paradox was a center for spiritual and cultural interests, a meeting place reminiscent of the cafes of Greenwich Village or Paris in the 1920s. A person could spend the whole day at the Paradox without buying anything, and no one would complain. The crowd at the Paradox was a mystical congregation, interested in teachings from the East. When news of the new Swami uptown at Dr. Mistra's reached the Paradox, the word spread quickly. Harvey Cohen and Bill Epstein were friends. Harvey was a freelance artist, and Bill worked at the Paradox. After Harvey had been to Prabhupada's place at Dr. Mistra's yoga studio a few times, he came by the Paradox and began to describe all about the new Swami to Bill and other friends. Bill, I was working at the Paradox one night when Harvey came to me and said, I went to visit Mistra, and there's a new Swami there, and he's really fantastic. Well, I was involved in macrobiotics and Buddhism, so at first I couldn't care less. But Harvey was a winning and warm personality, and he seemed interested in this. He said, why don't you come uptown? I would like you to see this. So I went to one of the lectures at 72nd Street. I walked in there, and I could feel a certain presence from the Swami. He had a certain very concentrated, intense appearance. He looked pale and kind of weak. I guess he had just come here and he had been through a lot of things. He was sitting there chanting on his beads, which he carried in a little bead bag. One of Dr. Mistra's students was talking, and he finally got around to introducing the Swami. He said, we are the moons to the Swami's sun. He introduced him in that way. The Swami got up and talked. I didn't know what to think about it. At that time, the only steps I had taken in regard to Indian teachings were through Ramakrishna. But this was my first time, to my knowledge, that bhakti religion had come to America. Bill Epstein, quite in contrast to Robert Nelson, was a dashing, romantic person with long, wavy hair and a beard. He was good-looking and effervescent and and took upon himself a role of informing people at the restaurant of the city's spiritual news. What's effervescent? you know, very, you know, energetic, like bubbly, like that. You know, effervescent, you know, you have those, like pills, you drop them in water and they fizz. Right, so that's effervescent, you know, very bubbly and happening like that. Once he became interested in the new Swami, he made the Swami an ongoing topic of conversation at the restaurant. Bill, I went in the back and I asked Richard, the manager, I'm going to take some food to the Swami. You don't mind, do you? He said, no, take anything you want. So I took some brown rice and other stuff, and I brought it up there. I went upstairs and I knocked on the door, and there was no answer. I knocked again, and I saw that the light was on, because it had a glass panel. And finally he answered. I was really scared, because I had never really accepted any teacher. He said, come in, sit down. We started talking, and he said to me, the first thing that people do when they meet is to show each other their love. They exchange names, they exchange something to eat. So he gave me a slice of apple, and he showed me the tape recorder he had probably for recording his chants. Then he said, have you chanted? I said, no, I haven't chanted before. So he played a chant, and then he spoke to me some more. He said, you must come back. I said, well, if I come back, I'll bring you some more food. James Green, a 30-year-old carpentry teacher at Cooper Union, was delving into Eastern philosophy. He lived on the same block as the Paradox and began hearing about the Swami from Harvey Cohen and Bill Epstein while regularly taking his evening meal at the restaurant. So all these different names that are coming up now. I mean, a lot of, especially now, the ones that get more involved, you see as time goes. As time goes, they'll all become initiated, and then you find out who they were. You know, when you hear the name, then you'd be, oh, okay. James, it was really Harvey and Bill who got things going. I remember one evening at Misra's in which Swamiji was only a presence but did not speak. Misra's students seemed more into the bodily aspect of yoga. This seemed to be one of Swamiji's complaints. His room on 72nd Street was quite small. He was living in a fairly narrow room with a door on the one end. Swamiji would set himself up along one side, and we were rather closely packed. It may have been no more than 8 feet wide, and it was rather dim. He sat on his thin mattress, and then we sat on the floor. We wouldn't chant. We would just come, and he would lecture. There was no direction other than the lecture on the Bhagavad Gita. I had read a lot of literature, and in my own shy way, I was looking for a master. Looking for a master, I think. I have no aggression in me or go-getting quality. I was really just a listener, and this seemed right, hearing the Bhagavad Gita. So I kept coming. It just seemed as if things would grow from there. More and more people began coming. Then it got crowded, and he had to find another place. The new group from the Paradox was young and hip, in contrast to the older, more conservative uptown people. Because like the uptown was where it's all the more established, especially on that side, Riverside Drive and that. So your established houses and all that were up there and all. And then you go farther, downtown, then you get, where it was all more young people and that around the Paradox in the East Village. So that was all young people and, you know, various degrees of crazy, more crazy, really crazy, like that. So they were all there. And so this is a new group that's coming to hear from Prabhupada, you know, more enthusiastic, more willing to, you know, try it, apply it, while the others were, you know, dabbling in it. They would like to hear, do a little yoga, you know, a little this and that, and then they had their life. But these other persons, they got into something, that became their life, you know. So most of the time it would be speculative. But this time, they were fortunate they bumped into Prabhupada, so it became real. The new group from the Paradox was young and hip, in contrast to the older, more conservative uptown crowd who had been attending Prabhupada's classes. In those days, it was still unusual to see a person with long hair and beard. And when such people started coming to the Swami's meetings on the west side, some of the older people were alarmed. One of them noted, Swami Bhaktivedanta began to pick up another kind of people. He picked them up at the Bowery or some adits, and they came with funny hats and gray blankets wrapped around themselves, and they startled me. Right? In other words, these are all hippies. Right? David Allen, a 21-year-old seeker who came up from the Paradox, had just moved to the city, optimistically attracted by what he had read about experimentation with drugs. He saw the old group as, quote, a kind of fuss-budgety group of older women on the west side, end quote, listening to the Swami's lectures, right? So they'd be all, you know, one would be more established, more dignified, more, like, sophisticated, and the other group is more, you know, young and crazy and independent. David, we weren't known as hippies then, but it was strange for the people who had originally been attracted to him. It was different for them to relate to this new group. I think most of the teachers from India up to that time had older followers, and sometimes wealthy widows would provide a source of income. But Swamiji changed right away to the younger, poorer group of people. The next thing that happened was that Bill Epstein and others began talking about how it would be better for the Swami to come downtown to the Lower East Side. Things were really happening down there, and somehow they weren't happening uptown. People downtown really needed him. Downtown was right, and it was ripe. There was life down there. There was a lot of energy going around. So he's saying it's all happening. Yeah, upset is all established. They have the life, and they may come a little bit, some of this. But downtown, it's all going on, and they really wanted him to be there. Chapter 6, on the Bowery. The Bowery's down on that Lower East Side there, but it's kind of like, how do you say? That part of it's not exactly, you'd say, hip, but that's where all the bums lived. All the guys that, you know, lost their jobs, this, that, whatever it is, and had gone down there and just lived on the street. I mean, literally slept on the street. On the sidewalk, that was the Bowery. So it was a pretty kind of like, you know, rough area. So this is where Prabhupada's heading now, to go downtown where it's happening. Right? I couldn't understand the difference between friends and enemies. My friend was shocked to hear that I was moving to the Bowery. And although I passed through many dangers, I never thought that, quote, this is danger. Everywhere I thought, this is my home. Srila Prabhupada in conversation. April 1966. Someone broke into room 307. What were we before? What was the dates? Didn't really say. March. Okay, no, it's just the next month. Someone broke into room 307 while Prabhupada was out and stole his typewriter and tape recorder. When Prabhupada returned to the building, the janitor informed him of the theft. An unknown burglar had broken the transom glass, climbed through, taken the valuables, and escaped. As Prabhupada listened, he became convinced that the janitor himself was the culprit. Of course, he couldn't prove it. So he accepted the loss with disappointment. Some friends offered replacements for his old typewriter and tape recorder. In a letter to India, he described the theft of a loss of more than 1,000 rupees, $157, from the letter. It is understood that such crime has been committed in my room. It's very common in New York. This is the way of material nature. American people have ample, everything in ample, and the worker gets about 100 rupees as daily wages, and still there are thieves who are one of character. The social condition is not very good. 100 rupees. Back then, probably laborers were here getting like 15 rupees or even less. Like that. Probably less, because I didn't start until... No, that would have been... Yeah, no, I would have been working with laborers maybe 15 years later than this, so they probably were getting much, much less than that. So he's saying they have everything, but still, because character is bad, therefore, then they still do all this crazy stuff. Prabhupada told Joseph Forster, the Scindia ticket agent, that he would be returning to India in a couple of months. That was 7 months ago. Now, for the first time since his arrival, Prabhupada had returned to the Scindia ticket office in Brooklyn. He talked about the theft to Mr. Forster, who responded with, "Welcome to the club," and told Prabhupada that the recent theft of his own automobile. Such things, he explained, were not unusual for New York City. He told Prabhupada of the dangers of the city and how to avoid thefts and muggings. Prabhupada listened, shaking his head. He told Dr. Forster that American young people were misguided and confused. He disclosed his plans for returning to India and showed Mr. Forrester one of his Bhagavatams. Prabhupada had lost his spirit for living in room 307. What would prevent the janitor from stealing again? Harvey Cohen and Bill Epstein had advised him to relocate downtown and assured him of a more interested following amongst the young people there. It had been an attractive proposal, and he began to reconsider it. Then Harvey offered Prabhupada his studio on the Bowery. Right, so you had down in that area, because that Bowery, that east side, previously I think that had been the industrial part of town. So it had all these huge buildings that were, factories in that. And generally the top floor, because they had the pitched roof, the pointed roof, then those were just empty. They were huge, huge places. And there'd just be one huge room, open room. And so then there was this thing that artists, because once it developed, wasn't so much the industrial area, that it moved out and people started living there. They confirmed, but these places weren't very considered so livable. So artists could get them for very, very cheap to rent them or buy them in that. So the basement and the attic, those were available for artists because they didn't have much money, but they needed lots of space for, painting or whatever they were doing. So that's what I mentioned, is offer probably a studio in the Bowery. So the studio would be this attic. But the nice thing about it was on the roof, so there was all windows in the roof. So they were generally very airy and light. And they were up high, so you could see out the city, a good view. So it would be inspiring to an artist. Harvey had been working as a commercial artist for a Madison Avenue advertising firm when a recently acquired inheritance had spurred him to move into a loft on the Bowery to pursue his own career as a painter. But he was becoming disillusioned with New York. A group of acquaintances addicted to heroin had been coming around and taking advantage of his generosity, and his loft had recently been burglarized. He decided to leave the city and go to California. But before leaving, he offered his loft for Prabhupada to share with David Allen. David Allen had heard that Harvey Cohen was moving to San Francisco. If he could sublet his AIR loft, AIR, capital A, capital I, capital L, means artist in residence. Like that, so that was that kind of loft. Harvey hadn't known David very long, but on the night before Harvey was supposed to leave, he coincidentally met David three different times in three different places on the Lower East Side. Harvey took this as a sign that he should rent the loft to David, but he specially stipulated that the Swami should move in too. As Prabhupada was prepared to leave his 72nd Street address, an acquaintance, an electrician who worked in the building, came to warm him. The Bowery was no place for a gentleman, he protested. It was the most corrupt place in the world. Prabhupada's things had been stolen from room 307, but moving to the Bowery was not the answer, right? Because 307, that's in a very, like, more, you know, upper class building and area like that. And so he's saying the solution's not to move to the Bowery, right? You know. Srila Prabhupada's new home, the Bowery, had a long history. In the early 1600s, when Manhattan was known as New Amsterdam and was controlled by the Dutch West India Company, Peter Minuit, the governor of Netherlands, stalked out a north-south road that was called the Bowery. Because a number of Boweries or farms lay on either side, it was a dusty country road lined with quaint Dutch cottages and bordered by the peach orchards growing on the estate of Peter Stuyvesant. I'm not sure that's not a fashion house. Peter Stuyvesant. Yeah, so Manhattan Island. If you've ever seen Manhattan, it would be a little hard to imagine, but this Bowery, this north-south road, I think Bowery is Second Avenue. So it goes from one end all the way to the other. And on both sides were farms, you know, just open land. It looked like, you know, this out here, you know, getting no trees, just open land like that. And it was just a dirt road. So that was the Bowery. So that was one of the first, you know, main roads that were established on the Manhattan Island. Right. You know, now it's all less farmy, I would think. You're lucky if there's even a tree on the sidewalk, but like that. Yeah, I didn't notice trees in the Bowery. It became part of the high road to Boston and was of strategic importance during the American Revolution, as the only land entrance to New York City. So that means, you know, the fighting with the British, the American Revolution would have happened also along there. In the early 1800s, the Bowery was predominated by German immigrants. Later in the century, it became predominantly Jewish, and gradually it became the city's center of theatrical life. However, as the history of Lower Manhattan describes, quote, after 1870 came the period of the Bowery's celebrated degeneration. Fake auction rooms, saloons specializing in 5-cent whiskey and knockout drops, sensational dime museums, filthy and rat-ridden stale beer dives, together with Charles M. Hoyt's song, "The Bowery, the Bowery, I'll never go there anymore," fixed it forever in the nation's consciousness as a place of unspeakable corruption. The reaction of Prabhupada's electrician friend was not unusual. The Bowery is still known all over the world as Skid Row, a place of ruined and homeless alcoholics. Perhaps the uptown electrician had done business in the Bowery and seen the derelicts sitting around passing a bottle or lying unconscious in the gutter, or staggering up to passerbys and drunkenly bumping into them to ask for money. Most of the Bowery's 7,000 or 8,000 homeless men, 7,000 or 8,000. Wow, I didn't think it was that many. Whew. Slept in lodging houses that required them to vacate their rooms during the day. Having nowhere else to go and nothing else to do, they would loiter on the street, standing silently on the sidewalks, leaning against a wall, or shuffling slowly along, alone or in groups. In cold weather, they would wear two coats and several suits of clothes at once, and would sometimes warm themselves around a fire. They would keep going in a city garbage can. Right, so people throw garbage in the garbage can, then you just light it, and then you sit around and you have a bonfire. Right? At night, those without lodging slept on the sidewalks, doorsteps, and street corners, crawling into discarded boxes or sprawled side by side next to the bars. Thefts were commonplace. A man's pocket might be searched 10 or 20 times while he slept. The rates of hospitalization and death in the Bowery were 5 times higher than the national average, and many of the homeless men bore marks of recent injuries or violence. Prabhupada's loft, 94 Bowery, was 6 blocks south of Houston Street. Yeah, because I guess he, 6 blocks south of Houston. Yeah, so that place, that area is, that I think, is called Soho. Because this means south of Houston. Like that. The first blocks were mostly restaurant supply stores, lamp stores, taverns, and luncheonettes. The buildings were of 3 and 4 stories, old, narrow, crowded tenements, their faces covered with heavy fire escapes. Traffic on the Bowery ran uptown and downtown. Cars parked on both sides of the street, and the constant traffic passed tightly. During the business day, working people passed briskly along the slow-moving derelicts. Many of the store windows were covered with protective iron gates. But behind the gates, the store owners lit their varieties of lamps to attract prospective wholesale and retail customers. 94 Bowery was just 2 doors north of Hester Street. The corner was occupied by the spacious Half Moon Tavern, which was frequented mostly by neighborhood alcoholics. Above the tavern sat a 4-story Bowery flop house, marked by a neon sign, Palma House, which was covered by a protective metal cage and hung from a second floor on large chains. A flop house, very bare facilities that you just go to, just sleep, So you just, go in and flop down like that. So it's a flop house. Like that, just a bare bed, maybe a chair, that's it, nothing, or maybe even nothing, just, like bunks or stuff like that. So you pay very minimal price, and then you have a place to stay. But like they said, then you have to get out in the morning. You can't set up there and live there. You can only sleep there. The hotel's entrance at 92 Bowery, which had no lobby, but only a desolate hallway covered with dirty white tiles, was no more than 6 feet from the entrance to 94. 94 Bowery was a narrow 4-story building. It had long ago been painted gray and bore the usual facing of a massive black fire escape, a well-worn black double door, its glass panels reinforced with chicken wire, opened onto the street. The sign above the door read, AIR 3rd and 4th, indicating that artists in residence occupied those floors. The first floor of the next building, North 96 Bowery, was used for storage, and its front entrance was covered with a rusty iron gate. At 98 Bowery was another tavern, Harold's, smaller and dingier than the Half Moon. Thus, the block consisted of 2 saloons, a flop house, and 2 buildings with lofts. No, that's the whole block. In the 1960s, loft living was just beginning in that area of New York City. The city had given permission for painters, musicians, sculptors, and other artists who required more space than available in most apartments to live in buildings that had been constructed as factories in the 19th century. After these abandoned factories had been fitted with fireproof doors, bathtubs, shower stalls, and heating, an artist could inexpensively use a large space. These were the AIR lofts. Harvey Cohen's loft on the top floor of 94 Bowery was an open space almost 100 feet long from east to west and 25 feet wide. That's quite big. Wow. That's longer than from on the other side of the building, that wall to that wall back there. And on 25 feet, yeah, it'd be like from that wall over to here, and then longer than that, very long. It received a good amount of sunlight on the east, the Bowery side, and it also had windows at the west end, as well as a skylight. The exposed rafters of the ceiling were 12 feet above the floor. Harvey Cohen had used the loft as an art studio, and racks for painting still lined the walls. A kitchen and shower were partitioned off in the northwest corner, and a room divider stood about 15 feet from the Bowery side windows. This divider did not run from wall to wall, but it was open at both ends, and it was several feet short of the building. It was behind this partition that Prabhupada had his personal living area. A bed and a few chairs stood near the window, and Prabhupada's typewriter sat on his metal trunk next to the small table that held his stacks of Bhagavatam manuscripts. His dhotis hung drying on a clothesline. On the other side of the partition was a dais, about 10 feet wide and 5 feet deep, on which Prabhupada sat during his kirtans and lectures. The dais faced west, towards the loft's large open space. Open, that is, except for a couple of rugs and an old-fashioned solid wood table. And, on an easel, Harvey Cohen's painting of Lord Chaitanya dancing with his associates. Seems he painted a picture. The loft was a four-flight walk up, and the only entrance, usually heavily bolted, was a door in the rear, at the west. From the outside, this door opened into a hallway, lit only by a red exit light over the door. The hallway led to the right, a few steps, and into the open area. If a guest entered during a kirtan or lecture, he would see the Swami about 30 feet from the entrance, seated on his dais. On other evenings, the whole loft would be dark, but for the glow of the red exit light in the little hallway and a soft illumination radiating from the other side of the partition where Prabhupada was working. Prabhupada lived on the Bowery, sitting under a small light, while hundreds of derelicts also sat under hundreds of naked lights on the same city block. He had no more fixed income than the derelicts, nor any greater security of a fixed residence. Yet his consciousness was different. He was translating Srimad Bhagavatam into English, speaking to the world through his Bhaktivedanta purports. His duty, whether on the 14th floor of a Riverside Drive apartment building or in a corner of a Bowery loft, was to establish Krishna consciousness as the prime necessity of all humanity. He went on with his translation and with his constant vision of a Krishna temple in New York City. Because his consciousness was absorbed in Krishna's universal mission, he did not depend on his surroundings for shelter. Home for him was not a matter of bricks and wood, but taking shelter of Krishna in every circumstance. As Prabhupada said to his friends uptown, quote, "Everywhere is my home." Whereas, without Krishna's shelter, the whole world would be a desolate place. You know, so Prabhupada didn't have any more security than the Bowery bums, but he was doing, you know, great, very elevated work, while they were not doing so elevated work. Right? You understand? So you can just see the difference in consciousness, and he'll do that no matter where he is. So whether he's uptown, you know, in Riverside Drive, which is like considered one of the nicest, you know, areas in the city, or down at the Bowery, which is definitely considered the worst area of the city. It didn't matter. Prabhupada does the same thing. Yeah. Often he would refer to a scriptural statement that people live in three different modes: goodness, passion, and ignorance. Life in the forest is in the mode of goodness. Life in the city is in passion. And life in a degraded place like a liquor shop, a brothel, or the Bowery is in the mode of ignorance. But to live in a temple of Vishnu is to live in the spiritual world, Vaikuntha, which is transcendental to all three material modes. At this Bowery loft, where Prabhupada was holding his meetings and performing kirtan, was also transcendental. When he was behind the partition, working in his corner before the open pages of Srimad Bhagavatam, that room was as good as his room back at the Radha Damodar temple in Vrindavan. News of the Swami's move to the Bowery loft spread, mostly by word of mouth at the Paradox restaurant, and people began to come in the evening to chant with him. The musical kirtans were especially popular on the Bowery, since the Swami's new congregation consisted mostly of local musicians and artists, who responded more to the transcendental music than to the philosophy. Every morning he would hold a class on Srimad Bhagavatam, attended by David Allen, Robert Nelson, and another boy, and occasionally he would teach cooking to whoever was interested. He was usually available for personal talks with any inquiring visitors or with his new roommate. Although Prabhupada and David each had a designated living area in the large loft, the entire place soon became dominated by Prabhupada's preaching activities. Prabhupada and David got on well together, and at first Prabhupada considered David an aspiring disciple. April 27th. He wrote to his friends in India, describing his relationship with David Allen. From the letter, he was attending my class at 72nd Street along with others, and when I experienced this theft case to my room, he invited me to his residence. So I'm with him and training him. He has good prospects because already he has given up all bad habits. In this country, illicit connection with women, smoking, drinking, and eating of meats are common affairs. Besides that, there are other bad habits, like using only toilet paper and not bathing after evacuating, etc. But by my request, he has given up 90% of his old habits, and he is chanting Maha Mantra regularly. So I am giving him the chance, and I think he is improving. Tomorrow I have arranged for some prasadam distribution, and he has gone to purchase some things from the market. Yeah, so Prabhupada's idea was that these may be the habits and everything that these people do. This is how they live. But Prabhupada wasn't satisfied to leave it that way. Right? Because the point is human life is meant for higher things. So out of ignorance, they don't know. So then he'll teach them. You know, it's not that, oh, they're like that, leave it alone. You want to just fit in and everything. No. His idea is who's interested, you teach. Right? Not interested, okay, you don't say anything. But you find those who are interested. You make that endeavor. You don't be satisfied that, oh, no one's like this, so then you leave it. No, you look. Right? And then we see Prabhupada, started over in Butler and then went down to New York, was with Dr. Misra and then moved into his own place, and now he's moved down to the Bowery. And at each time he moves, he gets more and more people interested. Right? So that's his whole point, is where are the people? So even if that means if they're living in the Bowery, he goes to the Bowery. Right? If that's where it's going to happen, then that's where he goes. Right? Does that make sense? So that's the main thing, is where service can be done properly. That's the consideration. Yes? No? Very good? Sure? Okay.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Jai.